country. Sitting around the dining rooms, and I had men tutors all the time.
To recap, then you did your two CRS placements and at St Thomas's and King's.
No, I didn't do King's. No, King's, I was saying, if you want to look at the medical social work training, it was a rather different hospital and assessment, different. No, I did Thomas's for 11 months.
Yes.
And about 5 months, it must have been 5 months scooting around his monthly tour.
Yes.
And a bit more than that. And then I went up to David Lewis,
Liverpool,
under Gwen Price, who was a marvellous person, teacher, rarely in the, and was one of the people who did rarely take you aside and talk to you about your work and so on more. And then when I got back, I was sent to do an unpaid, unpaid student locum for about 5 weeks at the North Middlesex County Hospital, which was the head arm of then was something called Margaret Coulthart. And then I went back to Thomas's for the autumn until Christmas time. And then I was told that there was, they were a bit anxious about whether I was quite ready to be qualified. And so they were going to give me another month, I think it was somebody called Agnes McIntyre, who in actual fact had pioneered medical social work over in Melbourne, I think. She was one of the very great characters, I think, in in medical social work. And she was back in Northcote Trust, so I bounced off to sit with her. In actual fact, it was very interesting. She gave me practically no casework. I don't think she gave me any casework to do. She'd take me round with her, and she'd chat. The only test she gave me, and I thought it was really, it was quite cute when you think of it. She had been particularly interested in a group of patients who had had operations to change sex because of physical problems. I don't think just because they felt man, they'd turn from women to men, but I think, you know, certain people have rarely deformities, as it were, which... And she had got a bundle of about 5 of her case records of these, and she shoved them into my fist, said, you read those and tell me what... I'd like to discuss them with you and tell me what you think about them. That's the only test she ever gave me. But one of the things I can recall is walking along an upstairs corridor in Thomas's with her. We were going to her medical ward, which was right at the far end, at the Westminster Bridge end, you know, and in actual fact, her office, I think, was right at the other end, the Lambeth Bridge end. And she said this was late, this was January 1937, isn't it? And she said to me, what do you think of what's going on in Germany? So I said, really, well, you know, one reads it in the paper, I don't know really what I think about it. But frankly, I wasn't very interested, I was much more interested in getting through my social work training. And as we walked along that corridor, she said, liberties. You know, being killed out there was the most dreadful, you know, the most dreadful things are happening. And if we don't, you know, to me, I can't now have a word to do. In any case, she sort of suddenly woke one up to an international political dimension. Now, I think she'd probably got concerned about this because the head almoner, Jerry Morris, had been much involved in helping German-Austrian refugees.
Yes.
So probably Agnes McIntyre had seen, but it wasn't in a sense because of these people. It was, I think, she suddenly put it in a few words I can't remember now, the absolutely glaring offence, you might say, against all the principles of liberty.
Yes.
which was going on in Germany.
Yes.
And how, in a way, I think she was almost saying, we will have to make a stand about it sooner or later, and we need to know where we stand as persons. And I think this perhaps was one of the things you could pick up as an emphasis. How much, in a way, one's how important to people in those days one's personal convictions were.
Yes.
And yet they were totally divorced from political convictions.
Yes.
In a way which is almost, I think, hard for us to understand now.
What they're expressed in a very generalised kind of way.
Well, in actual fact, that you can have a personal belief in liberty and social justice and find no political party which gives expression to it.
Yes.
And not even perhaps in those days seek one that gave political expression for it. I think maybe I'm misjudging people now, but I think in a way it's almost felt that you can't believe in social justice without you hook yourself onto one of the political parties.
That's right. Yes.
Or Marxism or something like that. And I don't think there was that sense. You had, but you had a very, you were brought up to a very strong conviction about the liberty of the individual and the right of patients to say not to have things if they didn't want it. I mean, there was no question of really bullying people into things. I mean, I suppose healthy persuasion, putting the points of view, you know, went on, obviously, and it goes on now much more than I think we're prepared to admit, probably.
Yes.
But, you see, medical social work rarely has, because it's working in an interdisciplinary environment, what we used to call in the old days a secondary setting.
Yes.
And it is the free, one, I think, from all hospitals, one of the freest from the taint of power of any social work.
Yes.
But you can, even today, perhaps less now than it ever was, because you could say we did exert power, but if we didn't, hadn't. Like Mrs. Snooks's face, we wouldn't have sent her on convalescence. Though this was, I mean, it would have been absolutely unheard of. She had been asked, they had said she needed to go to convalescence. You did your best to find the right solution. And this was another great emphasis which came through that you didn't take no for an answer, not from a you didn't take no if you had, you needed to find some resource.
Yes.
Whether financial or, you know, maintenance like a convalescent home or whatever for your client, you were a rotten social worker unless you got it.
Yes.
You know, and you would move heaven and earth for it.
Yes.
And I suppose when I went into community care ages afterwards, one realized this was a very single-minded, my client first, second, third, last, and in the middle.
Yes.
And when you got into community environment and saw that, you know, there were half a dozen people asking for that half of cake, you did perhaps see things slightly differently. But I think it stayed with one, and I suppose it stayed with social workers now too, this, you know, this is our client, and you get what they need.
Yes, yes.
And we'll fight for it.
Yes. And this is just coming back for a second to doing this placement. Then you, after that, you qualified and.
Yes, after that, I can't remember really how it all petered out, but I got my certificate and it was dated December 1936.
Yes.
So quite why? I think I was not a particularly traditional Thomas's type student.
Yes.
To be honest.
Yes.
I was acting more critical. I think slightly disbelieving in tradition in a way.
Yes.
I mean, okay, I didn't mind going along with it.
Yes.
But the never really subscribing to the sort of slightly heroine worship of Florence Nightingale.
Yes. Yes.
And I quite liked Thomas's, but I never felt deeply attached to it, and I came away saying, I don't want to ever work, I don't want to be a social worker in a teaching hospital.
Uh-huh, yes. Mm. So where did you go after?
The third application for a job, I got a job as the assistant almoner at a hospital called the Miller General Hospital, Greenwich.
Oh, yes.
There, head almoner, Miss Brennan, had gone back to Dublin, and Peggy Mears, who had been the assistant, was promoted. And Peggy Mears must have been about 5 or 6 years, perhaps a bit older than that, me. And sometime afterwards, she told me for three candidates who were interviewed for the job, they chose me. She was coming to me because she thought I was the least challenging of them. A kind of innocent which she could manage to manage.
Yes. Yes.
Which was rather funny.
Yes.
But an interesting, I suppose it's very personal really, we might want to cut it out, but on that selection committee was a very nice physician called Dr. Maurice Davidson. And about 2 days later, he met my father in Harley Street, and he said, "Hi, Gloin, we've appointed a young almoner by the name of Gloin." I don't think Daddy knew him well, but, you know, everybody in Harley Street knew a bit about everybody in Harley Street or Wimpole Street. Any relation of yours? So my father said, "Yes, that's my daughter." "Why didn't you tell me, Gloin?" And this was in a way, I mean, I think there was a good deal of telling each other, but also typical of the way my brother and I were brought up. Absolutely no permission to ever swing your family contacts around. You went into a situation and you could have, you know, you mustn't let anybody know that you've got this kind of background or that you've got a father, if he could pull strings if he wanted to. I don't know what he could have done, but you know. A very strong sense that you stand on your own feet.
Yes.
And we were both brought up with that.
Yes.
When you're being trained and we've got no money to leave you afterwards, or very little, a good education, you stand on your own feet in the world.
And so when you were in the... did you stay working in general hospitals like the Greenwich up to the...
I stayed until November 41. I went in March 37. I was just about getting myself around to thinking I better move.
Yes.
And was really very interested in trying to get one of the Commonwealth scholarships to do psychiatric social work at LSE. But of course, there was Munich in 1938 and war in 1939. And then I think one felt one just didn't want rat out of London. And of course one went through a lot of evacuation, and then all the Deptfordians and Greenwich patients drifted back. And then sort of 1940 you might say the war began in earnest. And one stayed on. I became resident in the hospital. Except for one weekend in... I went home every weekend, except one in four. Because Peggy Mears lived locally. And therefore it was... She didn't do any midweek living in. Which she did for 3 weekends out of the four. If casualties came in during the night, you were just woken up, you know, and one had...
Were you still a friend at this time?
Yes.
Were you involved with the Friends Relief Service?
No, not at all. I wasn't at all. For one thing, it was quite busy. Mm-hmm. I mean, after all, from 9 to 5,
yes,
I was an ordinary medical social worker. Directly, the office cleared of the day workers, I was an on-call kind of registering office for casualties. Blitz casualties. Mm. And sometimes one went for days without much. Mm. The downstairs, sort of semi-basement, nurse's dining room was sandbagged up, and it had about 60 beds in, and there was one bed allocated to social worker on call.
Yes.
And I also had a bedroom up on third floor restoral ward. And you sometimes start going to bed up there, and then, you know, you get a bit blitzy, so you come pottering down to your other bed, and you made a decision, I'm not going up and down those stairs every time the siren goes in and out.
Yes.
If I'm up, I'm up, I'm down, I'm down. But in any case, if the siren went, of course, you were supposed to be pretty available.
Yes.
And sometimes you'd lie in bed and wait until things, you know, until night sister would come and tap you on the shoulder and say, "They're beginning to bring casualties in, get up," more or less.
Yes.
And you get up, and you had forms to fill them in.
Yes.
And then the morning, part of the morning's work was, of course, these forms had to go off to whatever office they went to. And then there would be ambulances coming, evacuating some of the patients and some of the other. And there'd be strewn around outpatients all along the corridors, you know, as they came in and going to wards, and as soon as you could, you'd try and get hold of their names and addresses. And then, of course, if relatives came in to inquire about them, they probably ended up somewhere near the social worker's office.
I see, yes.
And so one did that on and off until, I suppose, the blitz really was practically over in May. And we settled down, you know, again. And then I decided I really must leave. You know, it didn't seem to be going to be an end of the war. Mm-hmm. And an student friend of mine, Thomas's, somebody called Margaret Burstall, had gone to the Radcliffe Infirmary, Oxford. And I think had been promoted head and then had a breakdown in health. And was given 3 months leave, sick leave. And she wrote to me and said, if you're looking for a job, well, you know, it's sort of temporary, but would you like to come here, you know, and work for 3 months? So I did. And there were a group of us there. There was Helen Bate and Jean Snelling.
Yes, I saw Jean Snelling the other week.
Yes, Jean Snelling was there, wasn't she?
Yes.
I think so.
Yes.
And myself. And I worked there, and I came and lived with midweeks with some friends in Kidlington that I've still got, who in actual fact, this friend and I went up to get to university together. She's now married to Don. And I stayed on until, for more than three, must have been more than 3 months, until Helen Rees was appointed, whom you probably have seen too, I should think.
I haven't seen her.
Yeah. And then, of course, obviously, you know, there was no notes. So I took, they were then, this was 41, and the Tomlinson report, I think, had come out about the rehabilitation of the handicapped. And there was a course, the Institute of Medical Social Workers was arranging a short course for people to specialize in work with the handicapped and learn about the services. And I did that. By that time, medical social workers, or ARMAs as we were called, had become a reserved occupation. And the responsibility for seeing that we stuck to our work lay with the Institute. And so from about March or April 41 and No, March or April 42 it would have been, until November. I did this course that they arranged, very much ad hoc. It included a month up in Glasgow attached to the Victoria Infirmary and looking at miners' centres and things like this up in Glasgow. And various visits to places like St. Loy's and Queen Elizabeth, and interspersed it with a hectic round of locums, because never a moment must I be out of work, you see, because I was reserved. And it was a very interesting 6 months, really. I did locum at St. Andrew's Hospital, the locum at Mile End. I twice did locums of Leeds General Infirmary. I did one locum at Stafford Royal Infirmary, and I did another one at the Dental Hospital in Bristol, and I shot around the country like this, which was a very good experience, actually. I quite enjoyed it in a way. And then I thought I'd better settle down. And curiously enough, I did not. I started applying for jobs, and I suppose there were more of us and perhaps less jobs around. I didn't get a job in rehabilitation services in the end. I ended up at the Redhill County Hospital, Middlesex, which was near Edgware, as an almoner, doing at least 50% maternity work.
Yes.
Under a very redoubtable character called Mrs. Owen.
Is this towards the end of the
war? Well, no, this would have been November 42.
Gosh, you did all those locums in that?
Yes, I was about one. Well, you see, it was really fascinating. Whatever, you'd be sent down to do a locum, say, at St. Andrew's, for which was an LCC hospital, for a week.
Yes.
Well, by the time you were checked in at County Hall and at the area office at Mile End Road, you arrived at midday on Monday. In case you nipped off before you got your pay, they had a system of paying you on Wednesday, so you got your pay for Wednesday. And on Saturday morning, you probably did in the office, but before, you had to leave a bit early in order to check in at Mile End area office and collect the rest of your pay and sign off. It was a fantastic thing. The others were more leisurely, as it were, didn't have quite these. Yeah, so I should go, and I'd come home for the weekend and I'd pack my bags and be off again on Sunday night.
Yes.
But it was no worse than if I'd been in the services, I'd have been doing much the same.
Yes.
And
yes.
And so then I settled down at this for 2 years, just over, at Redhill for two years.
Yes. During this early period, before we've been at 43 sort of time, were there any textbooks, or, I mean, what was the literature that you would have referred to during all this time? I mean, was there a literature to refer to?
I don't think there was. I don't think, certainly I wasn't reading it. Was our own little journal, the Almanac. One read various articles, I suppose, on this rehabilitation course, and had a copy of the Tomlinson report.
Yes.
But I certainly wasn't reading a great deal.
CMS reviewed it.
I don't think I was I think one of the problems was that unless you subscribed to it, and I was too broke to subscribe to it, you didn't get it. And I think the same, in actual fact, I'm wondering how much better off people, they are better off now. But there's still a great difficulty of getting hold of journals regularly if you're in the agency, aren't there?
Yes, that's right, yes. So as you were describing earlier, the practice ideas were actually transmitted from person to person by word.
I think so. Person to person by murder. And you picked it up as you went along. Of course, you discussed with other people. You say you read your almanac, you read the newspaper.
Did the Institute have meetings? anything to discuss?
Well, there was an annual general meeting. Now, when did the conferences start? I don't think really anything got, because it was wartime.
Yes, yes.
And there was precious little petrol.
Yes.
Quite a lot of people had gone into the services. I think, I'm not quite sure, but if you took any other profession, if you took, say, medicine or nursing, during those war years, we were pretty starved, I think, of professional input. People didn't have time to write. They were either on active service or scooting around the country like I was, or working in hospitals pretty hard.
Yes.
And I think it's applied probably to all professions. I mean, I don't know, were lawyers writing? I bet they were all in the, somewhere else.
Was that the position before the war as well?
Not so much, but I think social workers always have lacked writing.
Yes.
Whereas medicine has not lacked writing. Mm. Nurses, I think, got going perhaps more quickly on it. And social work, I think, was limited by the fact that it had its... had all its different journals. I mean, it was a yearly, I think it was, Journal of Psychiatric Social Work. Ours was a monthly one.
Yes. Well, that comes into post-war.
I'm not sure, but we didn't have, did I don't believe, during the war we had one. We had probably a sort of erroneoed thing with jobs and tiddy bits of information.
So, I mean, it would be mistaken, say, to... it'd be a mistaken assumption even to ask the question... about what the influential question today, which centred on what the influential ideas were, or who was what were the debates were, who was arguing for what. I mean, it just wasn't that kind of world, really.
I don't think so. I suppose by 1943 or 44, Beveridge's first document was out, and I do remember arguments about that. When I was up in the Leeds General Infirmary, there was a ferment of ideas, but I don't think there was much written about it. People were discussing it.
Yes.
And then that came out, and I was discussing perhaps what form a health service could take.
Yes.
Insofar as sort of casework, I suppose more and more... we were learning to talk in psychodynamic terms.
Yes, I was wondering about that. You know,
and this was the influence of people who had done the mental health course.
Yes.
And certainly when I was at the Miller, my second year was it? First year? Shortly after I was there. Yes. I suppose it was the first autumn. woman came called Daphne Phelps. Who had been, I hadn't really known her at Oxford, she'd been about 2 years senior to me in Oxford. She trained as a medical social worker, and then very quickly she had got a Commonwealth scholarship to LSE to do the mental health course, and I think it was she that inspired me, but told me about this scholarship. And Daphne came and was part, she had a job where she was PSW to the psychiatric outpatients at the Miller, and also did the children's wards and outpatients. And Daphne and I used to spend ages talking casework.
Yes.
And cases. And I, in actual fact, I think she was just longing to pass on what she'd learned in the mental health course, and I was a very open-eared recipient of it.
Yes.
So I got a lot, I think, really, in that first 2 years out of practice. Discussion with colleagues in the hospital, and we were a fairly young group of people, and so Daphne brought in this flow of of ideas. She formed the mental health course.
Yes, that's it. And isn't this?
But this is, it may have been more for me than most, I don't know, but I don't think there was sort of a the written, theoretical, formal input into us in those days.
I know perhaps it's not a fair question. I mean, can you sort of kind of pin it down to a time or a moment when, presumably, your own thinking must have taken a jump forward? Because once you got in sort of got into psychoanalytic ideas. You were into process, what happened between people.
Not, it was not, it was an exciting and interesting field. But I've always maintained that if you've been well trained in classical mythology, psychoanalytic theory is no stranger to you. And I was interested because I was reading reading a book on transactional analysis by two American chaps. And in the end, one of their chapters, they're illustrating something by saying, this is illustrated and I've got a whole list of classical mythology. So, but in a way, I don't think the Oedipus complex didn't come to any shock to one. And I suppose rarely, you see, my father had been medical advisor to a private mental hospital called Bowden House in Harrow. Bowden House. And this was where a psychiatrist called Dr. Crichton Miller, the very ancient perhaps person, worked. So that the atmosphere I was living in when I went home and we discussed work or anything like that, and I talked a lot to my father, was all pointing this way. So really it almost grew like topsy in one.
But were you ahead of your colleagues then?
I think it possibly was. Really. Maybe, I don't know, because, you know, you probably met colleagues and discussed things at equal level, and you best didn't meet the people who hadn't much time for it.
I mean, you make yourself, when we've been talking, you make yourself sound rather sort of kind of a retiring, sort of person who wouldn't be abrasive and sort of be...
I'm much more abrasive now than I ever was in those days.
But, I mean,
that's what local government taught me.
I mean, so... Presumably, people who are empathetic towards those ideas wouldn't be particularly challenged by that.
I think probably we've just changed the conversation a bit, you know. But I think, in actual fact, I never really felt there was great. There may not have been much exploration, but there was never really much opposition. And I think, as time went on, probably I was. Interpreting and thinking, in you might say, theoretical terms arising out of practice, maybe more than some of the people I met, to be honest. And I think this was not so much social work, it was probably the educational background I'd had, which had brought me up to philosophize a bit, as it were. And I think this could have been so. But when we discussed something, I might be became more interested and developed, at least to myself, the theoretical concepts and constellation of ideas around it and argued it out in these kind of terms and saw general principles in it rather than... and perhaps other people did who saw just, you know, examples for practice. But it's very difficult to say, really. One's never objective enough about oneself.
So what point did you go to the local authority?
Not to 1960. Had a long career, because after, after 2 years...
Just got quarter past.
Yes, 2 years at Redhill. Which was the most wasted 2 years, I think, in my professional life, because I really wasn't challenged. We didn't work hard. And the head almoner we had a marvellous talent, bless her heart. But directly got an interesting case, plucking it out of your hands and doing it herself. And I think I was a bit dissatisfied with it, and by then we'd had D-Day. That was June 1944, wasn't it? And I started sculling around for another job. And I ended up, I'm a very poor interviewer, interviewee. And most of the jobs I put in for, I never got. I was a mixture of being rather shy and then very naughty and saying things. Well, if you're going to employ me as a typist, and discovered there was no typist in the office, you really are not on a good economic wicket, are you, more or less? Yes. I pert, I think, along with being shy sometimes. In any case, I ended up at Cranford Lake, ended up at the Coventry and Warwickshire Hospital in Coventry. was the only person the application they'd had. Somebody called Miss Gurney had retired about 5 or 6 months ago. They'd appointed somebody else who had not liked them, and they hadn't liked her, and they'd parted company pretty rapidly, and they'd been empty. And they took me on, I suppose, frankly, because there was nobody else. We needed to fill the job. The hospital was already bombed and was only outpatients down in Coventry, and the wards were outside. And so there I went, and this I was completely, I was single-handed. Took over an office which had been without social worker, qualified almoner there for at least 6 weeks, I should think, with a backlog of work. And a charming senior secretary who spent the whole of the first morning. She brought one thing after the other, a perpetual, I remember thinking, my God, she's not let me have any peace at all, you know, by the time my desk was laid high with problem after problem, which she had been. However, I sorted myself out of that. And I worked single-handed for a year, and I was in lodgings in Coventry and drove home to Amersham where my family, my mother was, and family was. Most of the weekends, and as the branch hospitals were out of Coventry, I was very lucky because I got a petrol allowance, and a rather handsome one, which enabled me to drive, do quite a lot of driving, as well as one standard, you know, allowance. And then, I worked away at the job. It was a very interesting experience being single-handed, because owing to the kind of rather bad flavour that had been left behind by the previous persons there, and a not very helpful hospital secretary. I think it's true of all single-handed jobs. You don't talk, you know, there was really nobody to talk to. Honestly, you go mad talking to yourself. I wrote voluminous letters. There was nobody in which to share your professional life with at all, and it's, I think it's a very rugged experience, really, and should be one of the advantages of our present social services departments, but nobody is left in that position, or should be, and need be, where they're carrying total responsibility, without any professional safety valve, really, to talk to. However, I managed to get them to let me have an assistant, and we appointed somebody called Margaret Winterburne, who had just qualified. She had done a maths degree and then the quickie training, which was being arranged by the Institute. It was before the emergency. The emergency technically was post-war. This was whereby they ran a course, and you had to graduate in 2 years and do this course I did it in Cambridge. And about, I think only about half a dozen people ever did it. And Margaret did it, and she came, and we became very good friends. We're still good friends, you know. And the next year I managed to acquire another assistant. In fact, I ended up with a department of myself and three assistants.
I built it up from scratch,
yes, but all sorts of fair and foul meal means, as it were. I mean, I think in a way you became terribly manipulate committees, perhaps. Now you manipulated individuals, perhaps, who then put your case to a committee. And this went on, and I saw the health service in Coventry, and left in 1950. And that was something you might be interested in taking a look at, but at the stroke, quote Edward Heath, isn't it, or something. Of course, all hospital assessment went out, because it was a free service. And there you were at the end of June, going around collecting Coventry and Warwickshire Hospital Savings Association vouchers and saying to people, well, this is the week you pay, but you won't have to pay next week. And next Monday there was no, and there was no need to go around. And I think this was a tremendous jolt to those of us who had been in hospitals where there was assessment as part of our job. You know, was it, you really brought you straight out, was the raison d'etre of you being there financial? And I suppose to the committees it was. I don't honestly think to your colleague staff it was. And, you know, you went up to the ward and all this, said to sister, well, I don't need to see all these people to get money off them. But on the other hand, you know, you and I are pretty aware that it's not always money that's the problem. Shall I go round and see them all? Or how shall we play this one? And one sort of learnt how to play it a bit. And, of course, in actual fact, there were just as many social problems. One's formal caseload in one's case register dropped. Because one became more dependent on referred work, though one never, I personally never did referred work only in that hospital. And then that was, the war was over, a new orthopaedic surgeon came, a man called Watson. And he used Margaret Winterburn a lot. Things really professionally livened up the institute. Betty Reed became tutor. The emergency course started. Training got back a bit with a lot of new ideas. I started taking students at the hospital. Two kind of refresher courses were run at Offaly. In Hertfordshire, and Margaret went to one of them, came back with full of ideas, which we discussed, and some of them we put into action. And then in 49, the first Helen Rees by then had gone to become Director of Studies at the Institute, and Betty Reed had gone to be head of Thomas's. Because Cherry had retired. And they ran, Helen Rees ran a fortnight's course at Phillips House Dinton, which was YWCA Centre, on supervision, staff supervision of an invited group of people. And I was one of the people she invited to go, because I had had some. They'd been using me for student placements. And that, of course, was a great excitement in a way. Helen was peddling a lot of new ideas, which I found absolutely exciting. And some of them, you know, I'd been working on myself in a way. And we had to produce some case material, and great pride and joy. One of my cases was one of the ones we discussed. And it's an interesting group, because at that time, Cessa Vatt, particular Dinton fortnight, she was still a medical social worker. Dr. Cecily Saunders was there, who's now, you know, St. Christopher's, and then went on quite quickly, I think, to train as a doctor. Joyce Cuthbertson, who became the head of Westminster in the end, was there. The tutors were all there from Helen's course, which he was building up. Well, then two of her tutors, Helen Bate and Marjorie Moon, wanted to go back into practice. And Helen wrote to me sometime after that, it must have been nearly a year afterwards, and said that they were going, Helen and Marjorie were going to leave her, and would I consider applying for the job? And I did. And I, September, October 1950, I became a tutor under Helen Rees. And somebody called Doris Thornton, who's now head of the Middlesex, if she hasn't retired, who was had been at the London Hospital, also joined it. And,
yes.
And Jean Snedding was the senior tutor, and we were two plain tutors, shall we put it.
Yes.
And I had six very interesting, hard-working, immensely intellectually stimulating years there, and loved. Actual fact, it was the first big bit of teaching I'd done.
Yes.
It was very, very stimulating and interesting, and brought one right in. We were working in the Institute of Medical Social Workers, and of course one got to hear a lot more of what was going on professionally than I'd ever heard before, because I'd been really setting myself a little provincial course, as I wasn't going to go near a big London teaching hospital.
Yes.
Well, that brings you practically there. Well, when we're going up to 59, yes. Aren't we? I left the Institute in 1956 and shopped myself into the Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, on a Fulbright, independently of the exchange scheme, which was very naughty of me, according to the person who organized it over there, and had a very good 2 years in America.
Yes.
Came back in 58, and to my slight horror, nobody was interested in my splendid experience I felt in America. I thought I'd like to come back and try to do a staff supervision job, but rarely. It didn't work out that way. Don't know why, quite. But it just didn't. Whether I was too senior, I remember one person say to me, we've all got young almoners now, and we want somebody who's young enough to be the supervisor who's not going to look like a mother figure.
Yes.
Any case, I ended up taking a locum, a senior social worker, the geriatric unit in Oxford. And then I took the job permanently, and I stayed there until September 60 when I went into local government, into Bucks, and then I stayed until I retired.
Yes.
But did all sorts of different jobs. So that's my history, as it were. Yes, it'll only take me about 5 minutes flat to get that meal going.
Well, I wonder if I could ask you two questions. Yeah.